Radio Derb here, ladies and gentlemen. This is your ever-genial host, John Derbyshire, with the week's news. I'll confess I'm a little under the weather this morning, this first day of spring. Oh no! Anguished voices cry from sea to shining sea. What's wrong with Derb? Please don't be alarmed. The condition is entirely temporary. By way of explaining it, let me take you on a wee trip through Derbland. Thursday this week was the third Thursday of the month, and that means a meeting of my gents dinner club. A very exclusive group, invitation only, whose membership roster is graced by movers and shakers from the worlds of culture, politics and high finance. We have a guest speaker at each meeting, and we sit down to a hearty dinner with him at a discreet restaurant in Midtown Manhattan. We eat, talk, drink, and listen, and come away both instructed and refreshed, if not always confidently vertical. Our speaker this Thursday was Razib Khan, one of the moving spirits of the Gene Expression website. Razib is a very brilliant young man with interesting things to say about history, biology, and society, all from a population genetics standpoint. We had a great evening. Club members are allowed to bring guests along, and I brought two this evening. Noah Millman, who blogs at The American Scene, and his colleague Craig Witherspoon, a fine Scottish fellow of sound opinions. Well, we had our dinner and we listened to Razib talking about Etruscans, Hittites, lactose intolerance and sundry other matters. Then, after dinner, so this is around 10:30 p.m, Noah Millman and I, and Craig and Razib, decided to continue our conversation at a suitable location. Razib suggested a watering hole downtown, which he said was at Broadway and Lafayette, and he gave us the name of the bar. We went out to the street. Razib and Craig flagged down a cab and sped away, and then Noah and I flagged down another cab. Broadway and Lafayette are parallel, the cabbie pointed out, and he'd never heard of the bar. Oh dear. Our companions had gone ahead in their cab. We didn't have a cell phone between us, and we didn't know the other guy's numbers anyway. Noah told the cabbie to take us to Lafayette and Canal as a near approximation. We figured we'd find our way from there. The cabbie accordingly dumped us downtown. There was no bar in sight with the name that Razib had given us. We waylaid two young ladies coming out of a different bar and asked them. They had no clue, but they did have an iPhone. We spent a fruitless 10 minutes fiddling with the iPhone, looking for the bar that Razib had named. One of the ladies left. Noah and I went with the other lady to a random bar nearby and drowned our sorrows. The lady, it turned out, was a Republican. A Republican in downtown Manhattan. Bless you, ma'am. And may you never get into a taxi with no clue where you're supposed to be going. I finally got back to the Derb homestead out in the bosky suburbs of Long Island at 2:30 a.m. Fortunately, my station stop is at the end of the railroad line, so it didn't matter that I was fast asleep when the train arrived. I hope Noah got safely back to his home in Brooklyn. I hope the very kind lady with the iPhone got safely home to wherever she lives in New York City. I'm obliged to Razib for having taken the time and trouble to come and address our little club. I'm grateful to the ticket collector for waking me up at my home stop. Returning to consciousness in the grey light of dawn, trapped alone in a railway carriage in a siding in the wilds of Ronkonkoma, is a most unsettling experience. Well, I mean, I imagine it is. It's not the kind of thing that would ever happen to me personally. I am also grateful to the Kanasi tribe for having sold Manhattan to Peter Minuit in 1626, so that the splendid city of New York could be built as a place where middle-aged opinion journalists with three sheets in the wind could strike up random acquaintances in mysterious bars. The downside of all these Thursday night festivities was that when I arrived at Buckley Towers this morning and rode my private elevator up to the 95th floor, I was feeling, shall we say, not too tightly wrapped. My production staff was lined up to greet me as usual, but I could only respond to their welcoming cheers and applause with a whispered acknowledgement and a wave of the hand. And I was unable to join in singing the loyalty song, as is my custom. Fortunately, my personal masseuses, Mandy, Candy, and Brandy, were at hand to help me relax. Following their tender ministrations, I am sufficiently restored to bring you your usual weekly diet of dyspeptic diatribe across the airwaves here from Radio Derb. The show must go on.
Let's go on with the show.
One consequence of Thursday night's jollifications was that I missed seeing our president's appearance on the Jay Leno show. I could only read the précis of that encounter in Friday morning's New York Post, America's newspaper of record. Apparently our president bowls a 129 game, he is buying a dog for his daughters, and he has repealed all of contract law. I look forward to the president's upcoming appearance on the David Letterman show, when he will tell us about his experiences rollerblading, crack a joke about the drapes that his wife has chosen for the White House bedroom, and rip up the Constitution. A few days after that, perhaps the president's round of talk show appearances will culminate on Late Night with Conan O'Brien, when he will share his winning strategy at Gin Rummy, talk about his family vacation plans, and feed Magna Carta through a shredder. Every time I think I understand fiscal policy, I read something that gets my head spinning again. As if it wasn't spinning enough already this particular morning. Okay, try this. Who is the biggest buyer of US government paper? You know, bonds, bills, notes issued by the United States Treasury. Who's the biggest buyer? I'm not absolutely sure here, but it looks like the answer may currently be not China or Japan, but the US Treasury. Yes, Uncle Sam is buying his own paper. $1 trillion worth of it, according to the International Herald Tribune. Quote, having already reduced the key interest rate it controls nearly to zero, the central bank has increasingly turned to alternatives like buying securities as a way of getting more dollars into the economy, a tactic that amounts to creating vast new sums of money out of thin air. Well, not quite out of thin air, surely. More like out of our children's and grandchildren's pockets. But hey, we won't think about that today. We'll think about that tomorrow. Now, forgive my ignorance here, but the whole point of issuing a bond is to raise some cash, isn't it? I need some cash, so I put out a bond. A piece of paper with some promises written on it. And I give it an attractive rate of interest, and you buy it. Now you've got your bond, and I've got your cash. If I redeem the bond early, giving you your money back and taking my bond back, that can only be because I have all the cash I need and I want you to have some. So, presumably the Treasury won't be issuing any more bonds for a while, since it doesn't need the cash, right? Wrong. As Radio Derb has been reporting for weeks, the Treasury is actually stepping up the rate of bond auctions and the amount of paper that it's selling. It beats me. If the feds want more greenbacks sloshing around in the national economy, why don't they just print them? Oh, I see, that's basically what they're doing. There's even a small political bonus, as buying back Treasury paper reduces the national debt. Watch out for Barack Obama when he's up for re-election, telling us that even during a time of economic crisis, he lowered the national debt. That'll be a good line in 2012. If you can just put it out of your mind for a moment that a cup of Starbucks coffee in 2012 costs $500. The Centers for Disease Control came out with preliminary birth statistics for the year 2007, covering 98.7% of recorded births. We were a bit broodier than in 2006, with a total fertility rate, that's a TFR in demographers' talk, of 2.113, up from 2.100. Non-Hispanic white Americans had a TFR of 1.871, putting them in the international league tables with Ireland and Iceland. Non-Hispanic African Americans were at 2.135, putting them with New Zealand and Brazil. Hispanic Americans were at 2.995, up there with Malaysia and Bangladesh. The actual number of newborns in 2007 was a tad over 4.3 million. 54% of them non-Hispanic white, 25% Hispanic, 15% African American, and 6% other. What got everybody's attention, though, were the figures for out-of-wedlock births, which were up 4% overall from 2006, and up 26% overall from 2002. That's an increase of a quarter in just 5 years. The breakdown of that figure by race follows the so-called rule of four that shows up all over demographic studies in the USA, with Asian Americans at one end of the spectrum, then non-Hispanic whites, then Hispanics, and then non-Hispanic African Americans. The actual percentage for out-of-wedlock births are 16 for Asian Americans, 28 for whites, 51 for Hispanics, and 72 for African Americans. The notion of marriage as a precondition for childbearing is melting away before our eyes. Among African American and Hispanic citizens, most babies are now born out of wedlock. Pretty soon, the idea of having two parents will seem quaintly old-fashioned, like men's sock suspenders or fiscal restraint. How are things going with the show trial of Sheriff Joe Arpaio? Sheriff Joe and his travails are getting to be a running theme on Radio Derb. Joe Arpaio is the chief law enforcement officer in Maricopa County, down in Arizona, and he's made a name for himself by aggressively enforcing our immigration laws. That, of course, makes him a hate figure to the new administration, and in fact to all Democrats everywhere. When I see an illegal alien, I see a person who willfully broke US law, and who is now likely a net recipient of my money, via free healthcare, schooling, policing, incarceration, auto insurance, etc., etc. In the present economic environment, with 600,000 Americans losing their jobs every month, I also see an insult to American workers. When a Democrat sees an illegal immigrant, he sees a future Democratic voter. So, Democrats need to bring down patriots like Joe Arpaio. Otherwise, that swelling tide of future Democratic voters will swell a bit less fulsomely. Democrats are on the case. The House Judiciary Committee, under Democrat Chairman John Conyers of Michigan, is pushing the Justice Department to destroy Sheriff Joe, using their legions of lawyers and bureaucrats to hound him out of business and break his thumbs. Pushing behind Conyers is every group of leftist race hustlers in the country, including, of course, La Raza, the race, and the group that I unearthed for you last week, the National Day Labourer Organiser Network. NADLON, I shall call them in future. NADLON. Well, the latest development here in this ongoing story. 10 Republican congressmen on the Judiciary Committee have written a letter to Attorney General Eric Holder urging him to speak up for vigorous immigration enforcement and to give assurances to law enforcement agencies that they won't face the kind of investigation Sheriff Joe is being put through. Lots of luck with that, guys. A Democratic administration enforcing immigration law? We had to hire a team of wild horses to get the last Republican administration to at least pretend that they cared about our borders and our national sovereignty. In the eyes of Obama, Holder, Conyers, and the rest of them, when a law enforcement officer arrests an illegal alien, the officer is the criminal and the alien is the crime victim. Anyway, you 10 Republican congressmen who had the nerve to challenge Attorney General Holder and his allies, be warned. NADLON has you marked down for treatment once they've finished feeding Joe Arpaio to the dogs. My advice to you would be start moving your assets someplace the feds can't reach them. In fact, the Democrats are now getting brazen about their hatred of immigration law enforcement. Speaker of the House, Nancy Pelosi, addressed a crowd of immigration scofflaws and their enablers in a San Francisco church last Saturday. Referring to worksite enforcement actions by ICE, the Immigration Enforcement Branch of Homeland Security, Nancy said, quote, "It must be stopped. What value system is that? I think it's un-American. I think it's un-American," end quote. So, the leader of one of the houses of our national legislature, where our country's laws are made, is demanding that those laws not be enforced. Interesting. Nancy had been invited to the church by far-left Representative Luis Gutierrez from Illinois' 4th Congressional District, which is 74.5% Hispanic. Gutierrez is running a movement called United Families, which he explained to a Fox News reporter as follows, quote, "We think that families are the cornerstone of our society and our nation, and an immigration system should preserve those families, not destroy them," end quote. I must say I don't quite understand that. Our entire immigration system is oriented towards family reunification. Too much so, in the opinion of many of us. In fiscal 2007, for example, over 65%, nearly two-thirds, of immigrant visas were sponsored by family members already settled here. A foreigner who wants to settle in the USA is at a severe disadvantage if he doesn't have a family member already here, no matter how talented or worthy he may be. So, what on earth is Gutierrez talking about? Nancy Pelosi gave us a clue when she spoke of ICE agents, quote, "kicking in doors in the middle of the night and sending a parent away from their families." The idea is, you see, that if an illegal immigrant brought his family with him, or acquired one once he was here, then when you arrest him, you're breaking up his family. But why wouldn't that apply to any arrest of anybody for any reason? When the New York District Attorney threw Bernie Madoff in the pokey last week, wasn't he breaking up Bernie Madoff's family? Ah, yes, but you see, an immigration lawbreaker is liable to be deported back to his home country. If his family is left here, then you've really broken up the family. But surely the answer to that is for the deportee to take his family back with him to his home country. U.S. law doesn't forbid that, does it? What do you say to that, Nancy? What do you say, Mr. Gutierrez? Well, Nancy really worked that crowd of scofflaws. They were whooping and hollering. Quote from Nancy, "You are special people. You're here on a Saturday night to take responsibility for our country's future. That makes you very, very patriotic." End quote. Special people. Not like us boring, law-abiding, unspecial citizens and legal immigrants. What politician would bother to address us and our concerns? Nancy's right, though. Illegal immigrants are very patriotic. We saw that a couple of years ago in the Si Se Puede marches. Remember that sea of Mexican flags? Yep, these are patriots, all right. True patriots, doing everything they can to advance the interests of their country. Yep. Here's a nice, light-hearted story from Japan. Back in 1985, the Hanshin Tigers, a baseball team in Osaka, won its first Central League championship in 21 years. Well, we all know what strange and incomprehensible customs the Japanese have, and the 1985 victory kicked off one such. By way of celebrating, Tigers fans all made themselves up to look like their favourite team members. Then they all jumped off a low bridge into the Dotonbori Canal. Only one problem. They couldn't find anyone who could make up to look like the Tigers' champion power hitter. That's not very surprising. The slugger was Randy Bass, a large, fair-haired American guy from Oklahoma, with a beard. The Tigers fans solved the problem by taking a statue of Colonel Sanders from a nearby KFC franchise and dumping that in the canal in lieu of Randy. Alas, the statue sank deep into the mud at the bottom of the canal. Well, the Hanshin Tigers haven't won a championship since. Tigers fans have come to believe that the long dry spell is a curse imposed on their team by the late Colonel's spirit for their disrespect to his effigy. Imagine their joy, therefore, when a construction company working on the canal announced they had dredged up the Colonel's statue, minus his left hand and spectacles. Now Tigers fans are fired up for a winning streak. And so are superstitious speculators. The Tigers' victory back in 1985 was followed by a 5-year stock market boom. So you might want to watch the Nikkei Index this baseball season. Now you may have thought, based on the evidence, that the top priority of this administration, as of the last, is to provide jobs for Mexicans. Well, you were wrong. One consequence of the last mega-spending bill passed by the U.S. Congress was to kill a trial program that allowed Mexican truck drivers to take their rigs anywhere in the USA. Right now, they have to unload their cargoes so that they can be reloaded onto American trucks, driven by members of the Teamsters Union, who are, of course, the ones behind the killing of that trial program. This is a tough call for the poor commentator. On loathsomeness grounds, which are the ones I usually work from, there isn't a lot to choose between the Teamsters with their pickaxe handles and cement boots and the Mexican government with its ongoing project to recolonize the American Southwest after first converting the population into mumbling, helpless junkies. I'm going to hesitantly come down on the side of the Teamsters on this one. Not because I want to avoid getting fitted up for the concrete boots, but just on the Lyndon Johnson principle. You know, they're SOBs, But at least they're our SOBs. Mexico's retaliated against the ending of the trial program by sticking tariffs on stuff that we export to Mexico. It's hard for us to re-retaliate against that. The only thing Mexico exports to us are illegal drugs and illegal immigrants, and it's hard to get a good tariff regime operating on traffic that isn't even legal. I say, whack 100% tariff on remittances from US banks and post offices into Mexico. That'd tick them off, and it would raise a little revenue, too. Can we get the Teamsters behind this, perhaps? You know Nadlon's going to be fiercely opposed. The Teamsters versus Nadlon. Now, that'd be about worth watching. Better than King Kong versus Godzilla. And then there's those AIG bonuses. AIG, you'll remember, is the insurance company that found itself with a $2 trillion overhang after having insured a bunch of trades in securities whose underlying securities were based on underlying securities whose underlying securities were out on reverse repo but hedged with swaps against sorghum futures traded on the Ouagadougou Commodities Exchange. Well, it all had to be unwound, and the only people who could unwind it were the same kinds of experts who'd created it all. They cut a deal with AIG that they'd stick around to do that unwinding, on condition they got a nice bonus at the end of it all. Not having much choice, AIG agreed to the deal. And then, when the bailout happened, they passed that deal on to John Q. Taxpayer. John is mad as hell at having coughed up a trillion or so to a firm that's paying bonuses the like of which he himself will never see. Various Congress critters are mad as hell on Joe's behalf, and various commentators have joined the chorus of outrage. Not this one. A deal's a deal. At any rate, it is if it's legally binding, which this one is. If a legally binding agreement has politically ugly consequences, which should prevail? Politics or the law? Well, since the law is at least coded according to well-tried forms and customs, and mostly administered by people who've passed exams and who take pride in their independence, while politics is a vanity parade for people who have no marketable skills, and more often than not no principles either, Radio Derb votes for the law. Ugly consequences or not.
California, here I come. Right back where I started from.
If you want to see America's future, take a look at California. 4 weeks ago, after heroic struggles, California state legislators passed a budget that they said would close the state's $42 billion deficit. Well, now new numbers have come out showing that the deficit will not in fact be closed by that budget, and is in fact still growing. There's already an $8 billion shortfall looming up, and the legislature's analyst forecasts rapidly growing deficits starting in the 2010 to 2011 fiscal year. The reason, he says, is simple. This recent budget agreement consists of one-time solutions whose effects will drop out over the coming months. Washington's trying to help with the aid of perhaps as much as $50 billion, nobody's really sure of the number, going to the state from federal taxpayers. That's around $300 or $400 of your money going to prop up the California state budget. Why does it need propping up? Because it spends too much. Why do you think? Peering forward a little further, what will happen when the one-time fixes are exhausted and the federal stimulus is used up? Well, for sure, the client groups and the interest groups who are sucking up all that money are not going to go away. They're the ones who run the place. Just as the National Day Laborer Organizer Network runs the Justice Department. So California will have to raise taxes. That will drive even more productive citizens out of the Golden State, tilting the demographics even more towards people who need state services. So state government will need to do even more with even less. It's a feedback loop of corruption and failure, just like the one we've got going in Washington, D.C. Where will it all end? Probably with some colossal crisis as the swollen monstrosity of government topples over at last, crushing anyone who didn't get out of the way. When you're through burying those Krugerrands in the backyard, you might want to go out and buy yourself a survivalist handbook. On that cheery note, ladies and gents, I leave you. I can see Mandy, Candy and Brandy warming up another tub of massage oil. I'm downgrading my headache and nausea alert to non-critical, and I believe that after a rub-down from the girls, another dose of Alka-Seltzer, and a light quiche lunch with Jonah in the penthouse, followed perhaps by a soothing game or two of écarté, I shall be right as rain. Tune in again next week for more news of the coming apocalypse from Radio Derb. And the closing music clip here is for Craig.
It is so fun, it is beautiful, and its colors, they are fine. It was born a dirty offering in a skillet and a pie. My father wore it when a youth in bygone days of yore.
You!
And it's on the 12th I love to wear the size pie.